If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, the music industry's war on the internet. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when it was announced that Download Festival is back on.
News that requires you to know that the Download Festival 2021 had previously been cancelled.
Yes, I suppose so. But you know that now.
It was one of the UK's summer festivals, which was called off when it became clear that full capacity shows were not going to be possible in the UK until the 21st of June at the earliest, which I think comes just after what would be normally Download weekend.
Yeah, it was the weekend of the 8th of June that it was supposed to take place.
So once it was clear that that was the schedule that the UK government was working to in terms of relaxing the COVID rules, Live Nation, the owner of Download Festival, said, OK, that means there can't be a Download Festival this year, but there is going to be a Download Festival this year. Not only is there going to be a Download Festival this year, it's going to happen before the 21st of June.
Yeah, they've moved it back a week, so it's still going to take place before the 21st of June. Before restrictions are properly lifted, if indeed they are lifted on the 21st of June. But either way, Download is on. We don't know who's playing yet. And we assume it's not going to be Kiss, Biffy Clyro and System of a Down, who were scheduled to headline the original event before it was cancelled in March. Because there is one slight change they're making to the festival this year, which is that rather than having a capacity of, I think, 111,000... the capacity is only going to be 10,000.
Yeah, I suppose we ought to explain why this is allowed to happen before the 21st of June deadline, which may or may not be realised. But the reason it's able to happen is, as we may have talked about on Setlist before, I can't remember, here in the UK, the government have been running this thing called the Events Research Programme, where basically in recent weeks and recent months, they've been involved in various events, sporting events, corporate events and music and entertainment events with ever increasing capacities. And the idea is that these events, that we don't have social distancing rules, we don't have people having to wear face masks, certainly once they're seated in the audience. And it is to test how we can safely get higher and full capacity events back up and running as soon as possible. As I say, once the 21st of June is here, we still kind of hope. And so all this research has been happening. So there was those events in Liverpool, wasn't there? There was kind of a mini festival, which I think had a capacity of about 5,000 people. There was a couple of club nights run by Circus. Then obviously the Brit Awards was also part of the events research programme this year. And so this stripped back small version of Download is part of the events research programme because what they've not tested previously as part of all this research is an event that includes camping. So that's going to be the innovation on this stripped back last minute edition of the Download Festival.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if camping changes anything in the mix, because Oliver Dowden, the Culture Secretary, last week gave an interview to the Evening Standard where he said everything was looking good for the return of live music, because so far the test events that they've run have not resulted in that many new cases. It's only really a handful. And in fact, the Brit Awards, which ran as a test event, had no new cases afterwards. So it is looking good at the moment for live music to come back in full capacity. We'll see. The Department of Digital, Culture, Media and Sport were keen to point out that they haven't crunched all the numbers yet. And so let's not start saying it's all coming back just yet. But it is currently looking quite good. And fingers crossed, it doesn't turn out that camping is the thing where COVID spreads the fastest.
Yeah, Melvin Benn, the boss of the Live Nation division that runs Download Festival Public, actually talked about this event before it had been officially announced a couple of weeks ago as part of a panel organised by the live industry magazine and website IQ. And he was talking about how at a camping event, they will be testing different things. For example, obviously, you have lots of people in one place for a number of days rather than just a few hours. What you should have set up in case a COVID case is spotted during the event and what action you should be taking. So they will be investigating slightly different things at this festival event. I mean, obviously, the general consensus has always been that the chances of COVID spreading at an outdoor event is already a lot lower than at an indoor event. But they are going to focus on some slightly different things. And I guess the aim is, despite an assortment of issues around festivals getting cancellation insurance for the summer, there are still a whole bunch of festivals which are hoping to take place in July and August and September this year once the COVID restrictions have hopefully lifted. And so this test event, this stripped back download festival with, what is it, 10,000 people in attendance, will be investigating what those festivals need to be doing later in the summer to ensure that once the COVID rules have been relaxed, that we don't allow another surge of the virus to occur by staging these big events. So that was one thing that happened this week, but not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on we'll be discussing the latest depressing stats about musicians and Brexit. But first, the music industry is waging a war on the internet. Or so says US internet service provider Cox Communications in its appeal against a 2019 court ruling that said it was liable for its users' copyright infringement and, as a result, would have to pay the major labels $1 billion in damages.
Yeah, Cox Communications, this American ISP, surprisingly really, is kind of keen not to have to write a check for $1 billion to the three major record companies.
Yeah, I don't think it's their favourite thing to do.
So they've been doing everything they can to try and not have to write that check. So this was one of the big cases in the US, which was all about internet service providers, which the music industry is arguing have not been doing enough to stop their customers from using their internet connections to infringe copyright, to access and share unlicensed music. And this began basically as a safe harbor case, because, of course, an ISP like Cox Communications would say, as they have said in the latest legal filing and at every stage in this dispute, technically, under US copyright law, if you are an internet company and you provide services and networks and servers and platforms to companies or to individuals, and then those companies and individuals use your networks and your servers to infringe copyright, technically speaking, you cannot be held liable for that copyright infringement, providing you have systems in place via which copyright owners can do one of two things. A, demand that copyright infringing content be removed, and B, where you have users who are repeatedly infringing copyright, that there is some policy in place to deal with the repeat infringers. And providing you do those things as an internet company, then however much infringement is happening on your platforms, you can't be held liable for those users' infringement. But this was an important test case that actually began with a separate lawsuit pursued by the music company BMG, in which a precedent was set that the majors then relied upon in their much bigger lawsuit in terms of damages. And the argument was that companies like Cox, although in theory had a takedown system and a repeat infringer policy as US copyright law demands in order for them to have safe harbor protection, the argument was that Cox Communications had a deliberately shoddy repeat infringer policy, meaning that although on paper you could have sanctions against you as a user, as a Cox customer, if you repeatedly infringed, they never really enforced that. Actually, they told their staff to go really slack on repeat infringers. And as a result of that, the argument went, they didn't deserve safe harbor protection, so they could be held liable for their customers' copyright infringement. And in the BMG case, and then subsequently the major labels case, the courts and the jury decided, yeah, we agree. They didn't fulfill their obligations under safe harbor. They don't have safe harbor protection. There was loads of copyright infringement on the networks. We're going to hold them liable for that. Hey, Cox Communications, pay Sony, Warner and Universal $1 billion.
Yeah, that ruling came right at the end of 2019. And then Cox spent much of last year trying to get the ruling overturned or at least get the damages bill slashed in the court where it was originally sued. But none of that worked. And now it's gone to the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court, where it's going to have another go. And in a lengthy filing, it kind of runs through the entire history of the music industry's battle against online piracy, through the lawsuits against the file sharing platforms to suing individual file sharers, the calls from record labels for ISPs to play a role, and then the program run with various US ISPs, although not Cox, to send out warning letters to suspected file sharers, and then BMG's initial lawsuit against Cox Communications, and all the way up to that $1 billion judgment in favour of the three major labels.
Yes, it's a very lengthy lawsuit, which, as you say, goes all the way back to, Napster, really, and the start of the music industry's long-running battle against online piracy. If, like me, you've written about a third of a book about the music industry's battle with online piracy and all the legal arguments and the litigation and the legislation that has come over the last 20 years, I kind of feel that that book that I've never got quite round to finishing possibly isn't necessary anymore, because this lawsuit that has been filed in the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court, I mean, once you get to the middle, it's all the slightly tedious nitty-gritty arguments as to why the original court and the jury in that court got it wrong with that $1 billion judgment. But the first chunk of the lawsuit is, in essence, just telling the history of the music industry's battle against online piracy. And, I mean, you mentioned all the things they talk through. And interestingly, given how much stick the record industry got, do you remember back in the 2000s when basically the music industry was in a panic, because that's when piracy really started to take off online? Plus, of course, CD sales crashed and the record industry was panicking. And you had that period where two things were going on. First of all, they were suing the makers of the P2P file sharing software like Napster and Grokster and Kazaa and LimeWire, etc. But then they were also suing individuals who are using those platforms to share music and upload music and even download music. And I think at the time, particularly the lawsuits against the individual file sharers, most people, I think with hindsight, agree, and some of us were saying it at the time, that was a really stupid thing to do. It didn't achieve anything. You just got loads of bad press about the record industry. You just got lots of, you know, music fans of relatively limited means in court being ordered to pay stupid levels of damages. It was, in essence, a massive backfire on the music industry's part. And at the time, the hope was, okay, yes, we can't sue everybody who's file sharing, but if we sue a bunch of people and it goes to court and we win and they have to write relatively large damages checks and that gets lots of news coverage, everyone will then be like, oh my God, I mustn't file share online, otherwise I might also be sued. And it would be a deterrent. People would be like, oh, I don't want to be in their position. And so people would stop file sharing. Of course, it didn't work because It all seemed so distant. The chances of any one individual being sued seemed almost non-existent. And if anything, all the coverage of the lawsuits merely made that chunk of the population not aware that there was all this free music available on these file sharing networks, totally aware that all this free music was available on all these file sharing networks. So with hindsight, and some of us at the time, that was a really stupid approach by the music industry, which Cox Communications describes in its new lawsuit as a sensible approach to combating online piracy, because obviously if you're an ISP, you would much prefer the record industry be going after either the makers of specific software or websites that is being used to illegally access and share music, or the people using those websites, rather than the ISPs that those users are using in order to access the internet.
Yeah, so they basically run through this whole history of music and piracy on the internet, and then it gets to 2015 in its history, and it says, 15 years after Napster, the music industry launched an aggressive new strategy, attack the internet itself. Suing the internet service providers, the cable and phone companies like Defendant Cox Communications that deliver the internet. The record companies launch automated bots to crawl peer-to-peer networks for signs of infringement. Whenever they get a hit, they send a notice to the ISP declaring that someone using a specific internet connection could be the subscriber, but also could be a teenager, a houseguest, a coffee shop patron, or a hospital patient used the ISP's wires to infringe. They claim the ISP is just as responsible as Napster merely because it provided an internet connection. But unlike the offerings of Napster and its ilk, the ISP's internet service is neither designed nor advertised to promote piracy. And on this record, 99% of Cox's internet users never put it to that use. Your cable company also cannot monitor your internet usage or block specific online activities, at least for now. So not only does Cox not encourage infringement, it cannot prevent infringement over its cables any more than your phone company can prevent users from perpetrating frauds over telephone lines.
Now, of course, it's because of arguments like that. As an internet company, we can't control what's happening on our cables. We're just, in essence, a phone company. You don't expect the phone companies to be monitoring and stopping fraud that is occurring on the phone lines. It's because of arguments like that that the aforementioned copyright safe harbor exists. There is this principle in copyright law in the US, in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that says, yeah, as an internet company, if you provide services to people and they use those services, those networks, those servers to infringe, providing you're not aware of the infringement and providing you have those systems in place I talked about earlier to get copyright infringing content taken down, to deal with impeded infringers, you can't be held liable for your copyright infringement. But, as I said, the key argument in the case against Cox Communications, both the original BMG case and then the major labels case, is that because Cox allegedly had this deliberately shoddy system for dealing with repeat infringers on its network, it lost that safe harbor protection and hence could be held liable for the copyright infringement. However, in this very long filing with the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court, after going through the entire history of online music piracy and all the various developments along the way, it basically says, even if we lose our safe harbor protection because of the allegations that we had this deliberately shoddy policy for dealing with repeat infringers, because of various emails that surfaced as part of the original BMG case that seemed to show that Cox employees had a very slack attitude towards enforcing repeat infringer policy, what Cox Communications then says is, even if we don't have safe harbor protection, the major record companies still have to prove that we are liable for the copyright infringement that occurred on our networks. Now, obviously, Cox Communications is not directly infringing the copyright. It's not directly uploading the unlicensed files or downloading the unlicensed files. But you can be held liable under copyright law for what we sometimes call contributory infringement, or under UK law, it would be called authorising infringement, when in essence you facilitate the infringement. And you can be held liable even though you're not actively involved in the infringement. And so that is what Cox Communications is being held liable for once it's lost its safe harbour protection. But a big chunk of the appeals filing with the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court is basically saying, even if we don't have safe harbour protection, you still have to prove that we are liable for contributory infringement, that we tick all the boxes that case law tells us you've got to tick in order to prove contributory infringement. And their argument is that in the BMG case, and more importantly, in the major labels case, they reckon, obviously, the jury did not agree in this case, but they reckon that a case for contributory infringement was not successfully presented by the record companies, and that's why they want the appeal judges to review the evidence, to reconsider the arguments, and ultimately to overturn that $1 billion judgment.
Yeah, Cox then sets out a whole load of arguments as to why, despite judgments to the contrary, the music industry has not actually proven that it is liable for contributory infringement. And a lot of that is based on the various issues the ISP has had with infringement notices that it's routinely sent by the RIAA and its anti-piracy agent, Mark Monitor, something Cox also talked a lot about during the original court case involving the majors. It reckons that the lower court was wrong to ignore those issues and side with the record companies, and it says those errors resulted in an award of historic proportions. The $1 billion judgment is entirely untethered from both the harm it caused and Cox's culpability. Cox, after all, it goes on, did not directly infringe any of plaintiff's works, encourage anyone to infringe, or create or supply the peer-to-peer protocols and platforms that enable that infringement. Instead, Cox's liability rests on the theory that it should have been a more active bystander by cutting off infringing subscribers' internet connections sooner, a delicate calculus based on competing duties to copyright holders and customers.
Yeah, it then ended its lawsuit as dramatically as it had started. So by opening up claiming that the music industry had gone to war with the internet at the end of this very, very long filing with the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court, it concludes, if the ruling of the lower court is sustained, this judgment would elevate the interests of the music industry over those of ordinary and often blameless people who depend on the internet. The consequences will be devastating. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. I mean, as we said, if the $1 billion damages stay in place, it will be devastating for Cox Communications. Whether it will be devastating for the average internet user, I guess, is a debatable point.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And finally this week, as the music industry continues to lobby the UK government over the post-Brexit bureaucracy that performers touring Europe are facing as COVID restrictions start to lift, last week the Musicians' Union and the Incorporated Society of Musicians released results of a new survey that they've done of their member musicians, and they found that 77% of artists expect their earnings to decrease as a result of the new visa, travel permit and carné requirements that they now face. A significant number of musicians are not expecting to tour Europe at all as a result of those new requirements. Others are considering relocating to countries within the EU, and a fifth are considering leaving the music industry entirely.
Yes, so this all relates to the post-Brexit trade deal that was agreed very last minute last year between the UK and the European Union. We've talked about this at length on the podcast already and written about it loads in the CMU Daily. But just to recap, you will remember that there was no EU-wide pan-European provision in that trade deal that said that British musicians could continue to perform and tour around the EU without there being any new bureaucracy to navigate, despite the music industry having pointed out on numerous occasions prior to the deal how important it was that Brexit did not mean that musicians would have to navigate new bureaucracy when they toured Europe. They had been assured many times by ministers that that was fine. There was going to be something in the deal to make sure that didn't happen. It wasn't in the deal. And so ever since the start of the year, the music industry has been faced with the prospect that once COVID rules relax and touring across Europe is possible again, musicians will have to basically comply with the bureaucratic requirements of each individual EU member state when they're touring Europe. So in some countries, actually, it won't make any difference. They'll be able to continue to go in and play shows without having to do any more paperwork, just like they did when UK was part of the EU. But in other countries, there may be visa requirements, travel permit requirements, carné requirements. So in some countries, the musicians might be able to get into the country without any extra paperwork and costs, but their equipment won't. There's also some new regulations and rules around haulage around Europe. And all of these mean that once those COVID restrictions lift, any artist touring Europe, and indeed their crew members and their team, in every country they go to, are going to have to say, okay, what paperwork, what bureaucracy do we have to do in this country? When do we have to do it by? What forms do we have to fill out? What are the costs? And there are lots of artists who fear that for a European tour, it could add thousands of pounds to the budget for the tour. And up to a certain level in the hierarchy of live music, an extra $5,000 costs on a tour's budget is what makes that tour impossible. And so the music industry has been saying from the moment that this trade deal was made public late last year, this is a massive problem. But in a weird kind of way, COVID has provided us with a window of opportunity to solve this problem. You know, had it not been in the middle of the pandemic and this trade deal had gone through late December and all these artists would have been touring in January, February, it would have been a disaster. But because nobody could tour anyway, we had this opportunity. We didn't know at the time whether it was going to be 3 months or 6 months. It turns out that it's probably 7, 8, 9 months. But we have a period of time where artists can't tour anyway. So hey, UK government, hey, European Union, hey, governments of each EU member state, can we just get some deals done? Whether that's an EU-wide deal, probably unlikely, or individual deals with each EU member state where currently there is bureaucracy facing British musicians to get rid of that bureaucracy and all the costs associated. Can we not try and get that done before COVID restrictions relax? But even though everybody in government and loads of people in Parliament are saying to the music industry, you're right, this is a problem, we need to fix this, what we're hearing from the MU and the ISM and others is the progress being made. Well, there isn't any progress being made as far as most people can see. There doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency amongst government to actually get this fixed before the COVID restrictions lift. And that is a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said months ago now that he was passionate about getting this sorted. And I mean, I guess he's had other things on his plate, but this is important, particularly as we come out of the pandemic and movement around Europe becomes possible again. So the MU and ISM are obviously releasing these survey results as part of the ongoing attempts to kick politicians into gear. And obviously, as I already said, that 77% stat of musicians who expect their earnings to be down as a result of all this new post-Brexit bureaucracy. And the MU and ISM in a statement said, this is due to the additional documents musicians require for themselves, like work permits and visas, and for their equipment, customs documents like ATA carnets. Transport expenses have also risen due to new road haulage requirements, and some survey respondents expect that when combined, all these costs could add up to as much as £15,000 extra per tour. According to the survey, only 43% of musicians are still planning to tour or do shows in the EU at all in future, at least until these issues are sorted. And then 42% of musicians would consider relocating in order to continue working without having to go through all this red tape. And 21% are considering a change of career entirely.
Yeah, so commenting on the findings of this survey, MU General Secretary Horace Troubridge said, this survey shows that the UK's musicians are contemplating drastic action due to the enormous obstacles they face in taking their world-renowned talent into the EU marketplace. This government failed to ensure that performers would be protected from acres of bureaucracy and additional costs when the post-Brexit trade agreement was negotiated. As a result, we may lose a large chunk of the talent that underpins our £5.8 billion music industry. Noting, as you said, that Boris Johnson previously told Parliament that he was passionate about finding a solution to these problems, Troubridge went on, the Prime Minister needs to step in and sort this mess out now, just like he promised he would in the House of Commons a few weeks ago, because of course everything that Boris Johnson says we know is definitely true and not some made up bullshit to please the room at the time. I mean, he has had some other things to deal with in recent weeks, but I mean, mostly as a result of past bullshit. So, you know, I think he probably could find some time to fix this. The damage done to the UK music industry if the government does not act is immeasurable. And I have to say, you know, both of our stories on this week's set list ending with bold statements. Cox Communications saying that if that $1 billion copyright infringement judgment stands, that will be devastating. And then Horace Troubridge from MU saying that the damage of the post-Brexit bureaucracy, unless we can get rid of it, will be immeasurable. I have to say that I'm more prone to believe that the latter of those statements is a genuine, credible warning than the former. And it remains to be seen as, I mean, obviously, as we said earlier, we're hoping that COVID restrictions properly lift towards the end of next month here in the UK. It will probably take a little bit longer in lots of other parts of Europe. And even obviously, once any one country has lifted COVID restrictions, there may still be international travel restrictions in place. But we are hoping that some sort of touring will come back online in the autumn, if not sooner. And I mean, the chances of having this bureaucracy mess sorted by then is looking less and less likely. But it is hoped that by continually talking about this and raising more attention of these problems, maybe the government will do something.
Yes, but we'll have to wait and see if the internet collapses and the British music industry collapses. Maybe that's something for next week, because that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Do remember that you can subscribe to receive the show automatically every week if you have not previously done that. Pressing the subscribe button is so much fun if you've never done it before. I really recommend it. You can also rate and review, which is, or if anything, it's even more fun. So you do that. And if you've got any questions or comments about the show this week or any other week, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.